You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
So she is deep into Hamilton's life.
How old is she?
She's just turned 12.
And she read the Ron Chernow 800-page biography on Hamilton?
Indeed. She was totally into it.
Christians do this all the time with the parts of the gospel that are congruent with what we want to think about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we leave on the table the stuff that's a little bit more like sandpaper.
The more you sit down and actually read the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, the more compelling he's going to be.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rebecca McLaughlin. How are you, Rebecca?
I am hot. that came out so wrong.
Yeah,
let's try.
Well, Engineer Brad, you can just clean that up. Maybe put an applause break behind it or something. You mean you're physically warm.
I had to break into our associate pastor's office today because my internet was down at home. And if I put the air conditioner on, I think it'll be really noisy. So I'm just sweltering. Maybe that's the word that I was looking for.
You know what? We're going to stick with sweltering on this. And okay. I'll tell you, I was sweating looking. You posted a picture on Twitter that looked like a torture trap. It looked terrifying to me. It was like this, it looked like a skyscraper that then had like a swing on it. And you said you did this with your daughter and it, I showed it to my wife and I was like, this is my worst nightmare right here. Being stuck on one of these is my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. So
how did you get coaxed into that?
Gosh, it's a long story. We went to Six Flags New England, which I would not recommend. We had terrible customer service experience, which I still feel the rage from.
Dang.
So I'm letting it go.
Shots fired. If there's anybody who works at Six Flags New England listening, just
let it be known that if you have a summer pass, that doesn't mean you have a season pass, even though summer is a season and it is still summer. As I'm talking right now, it is anyway.
Well, I'm sure an attorney somewhere would disagree with you on how the fine print was written. But all right, so you're there though.
So we're there, and my 10-year-old wants to go on this absurd thing, which is like a massive pole, imagine the tallest New York skyscraper, and it's just a pole, except that it has this thing that goes up and down and swings, little pairs of swings dangling, that as they go up, they start spinning. And so not only do you get higher, but you also start to sort of splay out and swing around. And my 10-year-old was like, I really want to go on that thing. And we hadn't been able to do there were various things we hadn't been able to do for various reasons. My husband wasn't there. He would be the guy to go and do the swing thing. And I thought, you know what? My little girl wants to do this thing. I am quite scared of heights.
Me too.
So I went with her and I said to her, I'm probably going to have to close my eyes and sing Amazing Grace to make this work. But I thought, maybe I'm braver than that. Maybe I am. So we get in these swings and they start to lift up. And about 10 feet off the air, I was like, off the ground, I was like, okay, I think I need to close my eyes right now. And my little girl's going, Mommy, the view is so great. I'm seeing this, I'm seeing that. And I'm like, keep telling me, but I cannot, if I open my eyes, it is all over for me right now. And the only good thing I knew about this ride was that it was a minute and a half long. And I'm like, I can sing and close my eyes for a minute and trust my soul to the Lord.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening here.
Well, that's where I would have been too. I've seen a video of somebody on that swing and it was a guy and he's passed out and his limbs are just limp as the swing is going around. And that would be me. I would open up my eyes. I have terrible fear of height and I get terrible motion sickness. So that thing, going around really fast in a circle, really high up, out in the open air, that is my, but I'm like this with all heights. I'm a terrible flyer. Every time I get on a plane, in my head, I'm thinking, this is defying God. I should not be. None of us should be up here. We were not created to fly. I shouldn't be up here flying. This is an act of defiance against the Creator. And this doesn't.
It's like the Tower of Babel all over again. Yes,
it's this does not seem right. And so roller coasters have always felt just flagrantly looking up at God and being like, you know those limits you put on us? Yeah, we're going to scratch those limits real quick and just fling our bodies about on these rickety old roller coasters. I cannot do it.
Yeah. Well, here's the spiritual thought that I had as I got into that swing. And I know we all need to hear my spiritual thoughts on a random swing in New England. But it's that conflict between what your senses tell you and what your brain tells you. Because my senses said, it is unsafe to be flying or like whizzing around in the air on that spindly little piece of metal. It's just, you may as well die now as go on that thing. But my rational brain said, you know what? This thing has been designed specifically so that people can do it safely. And this whole theme park would have been closed down years ago if that was not in fact safe. So I had this battle between my rational self and my kind of instinctive emotional self, I guess. But the only way that I could allow that piece of me that knew this was safe to go ahead and like win the day was by closing my eyes and singing to the Lord. And in some ways it did, I know this sounds sort of cheesy, but it did feel a bit like a metaphor for the Christian life, that there are there are so many times when I am closing my eyes and singing to the Lord and clinging on to trust in him, even when it really, everything within me is crying out something else because I'm flying around some crazy thing in the sky, you know?
I got to tell you, if I didn't know that you were godlier than I was, I do know now, because I would not be, I would not be making those connections. I would not have roller coaster reflections with Rebecca going on in my head while I'd be like, this was a terrible mistake. I'm a good dad. I'm a good dad. I did this to prove to my daughter I'm a good dad. It'd be all selfish. It'd all be like so self-serving. I'd be like, wow, I just built a lot of bonus points in with my daughter for that bravery right there. But, you know, not only are you godlier than me, you're more prolific. Rebecca has about 25 books coming out this year. And two of the...
You're a liar. Well, that's your main problem, Kyle.
Hey, listen, if it's not 25, it's like within a multiple of that. Like it's not far away. I don't know. I was telling Rebecca offline, like, I don't know. I feel like all of the British evangelicals I know have just chosen to be like incredibly prolific with their life. So they're just pumping stuff out. But two of the books are releasing this year are Jesus Through the Eyes of Women, which is recently released, and Confronting Jesus, which is soon to be released. Let me just, like, why all this interest in Jesus? Is that
great question.
What's the big deal about Jesus, Rebecca?
Here's the thing. I write because I really love writing, and I know that's like a nerdy sort of weird thing to say, but it's true. Like some people like woodwork and some people like, you know, sculpting from clay, and I really find writing to be emotionally satisfying for me. So I know I want to be writing. And the books that I've written prior to this little spate of writing books focused on Jesus or with Jesus in the title, those have been books that were more apologetics focused in the sense of sort of taking an issue, thinking through it, connecting it to the scriptures. And I wanted to spend more time actually just in the scriptures and putting that foot first rather than the sort of questions and issues first. So in some ways it's just been selfish. It's been an excuse for me to spend more time in the Gospels, particularly educating myself more, learning more of the Lord there. And it's just been, super satisfying for me kind of emotionally and spiritually just to do that. And Confronting Jesus in particular, I wanted to write as sort of like a follow-up to Confronting Christianity, which my hope with that first bit was to say, you know, think of your most skeptical friend who has all sorts of reasons why they wouldn't be interested in Christianity. Like maybe this book can help address some of those issues. Confronting Jesus is more like, okay, if somebody's read that book or somebody's ready to seriously consider Jesus, but maybe not quite ready to pick up the Bible for themselves and just start reading, that this book would be a little bit of a bridge to help them get oriented with what the Gospels are, why we should see them as reliable, and then what do we learn about Jesus in the Gospels? So kind of like a gateway drug to people reading the Gospels.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Well, just get the conversation going. What if we're wrong about Jesus? Like what if you and I are wrong about who we believe Jesus is and what we believe Jesus has done? Because there are objections, right? I mean, not everybody in the world sees Jesus differently or sees Jesus the same way. So let's just start there. What are some of the common objections about Jesus? Just to get them on the table, to kind of know who we're talking to and who we're talking with. What are some of the common objections? You can throw out a couple, I'll throw out a couple.
Yeah, so I think some people would say, you know, Jesus was clearly a great, incredible ethical teacher. You know, no question, his teachings changed the course of ethical, moral history. And so, and he was, you know, somebody like Richard Dawkins, the new atheist folks would say, he was very much behind, ahead of his time in terms of his ethics.
Right.
But the idea that he is God in the flesh, that he is in fact so much more than a good teacher, but identifies as the creator of the universe and of you and me, and that he has some you know, fundamental role to play in our ultimate sort of spiritual destiny, that is an exaggeration that's accrued around Jesus since the time that he was preaching, and that Jesus himself would never have said. Right. You know, people say, well, Jesus never claimed to be God in the gospel. So I think that'd be one, that gap between Jesus, the great moral teacher, and Jesus, the Son of God.
That certainly seems like the one that has the most popular cachet. Like, very rarely do you meet somebody, at least in the global West, do you meet somebody who just is like absolutely despising that model of Jesus, where they're like, they won't acknowledge its historicity. That's very rare. There are some who object to the historicity of Christ. They would say the whole notion of a literal person who was Jesus Christ, moral teacher, God, or whatever, that's historically inaccurate. That's less in vogue. It's a minority opinion. What is a lot more in vogue and popular is, yeah, Jesus was a good guy. He was a good teacher. I like Jesus, but, you know, his followers are a problem. You know, he really wasn't God in the flesh. And there's kind of sometimes rational objections to that. Like, I could not possibly believe that Jesus was God in the flesh because it would presume that there's, you know, a God who is above nature, supernatural, immaterial, and that he would be able to take on flesh. So that's kind of more of like a rational objection. There's kind of moral objections to it, which is that, you know, I don't believe Jesus is Lord because it would be a totalizing claim. And that kind of claim would submit other people who don't believe in the exclusivity of Christ, that he is not just God, he is unique in being the Son of God and the rescuer of the world, that's a moral objection, that it feels unpalatable, that he would, if he is God, then he must be exclusively so. And if that's the case, that's unpalatable morally, because it's not very, it doesn't have the universal in mind.
And even doesn't have I think that there's such a strong emphasis today on people saying, you know, my truth and your truth.
Yes,
can both be valid and true, but just different.
Right.
And that's, on some things, that's correct. You know, your food preferences and my preference, you know, I could think that this coffee is better than that coffee and you vice versa. And we could both be, you know, true in our own little worlds. That's fine. But actually Jesus this is not the kind of truth that there could be your truth and my truth. But I think a lot of folks today want to say, you know, it's what, if Jesus works for you, that's great. I would be the last person to say that he isn't God, if that's what, you know, floats your boat, essentially.
Right.
But the claim that Jesus is universal Lord of all, regardless of anyone's you know, religious beliefs, that's where it gets really unpalatable for folks today, I think.
Yeah, and certainly in a globalized world where we're in closer conversation, well, that's probably not accurate. Closer, we're more aware. I wouldn't say that we're in closer conversation, but we're more aware of other worldviews and religions. And I think one of the things, certainly in the last 20 years, as Islam has become more of a reality and presence and just people's lived experience in the global West. I mean, just in terms of neighbors who are Muslims, or friends who are Muslims, coworkers, employees who come from the Islamic tradition, certainly that has become a conversation partner in beliefs about Jesus as well. You can find Isa in the Quran. You can find references to Jesus in the Quran, but the understanding, the Muslim understanding of Jesus is not that he was the Son of God, certainly that he was not God in the flesh, but that he was a moral teacher and a moral prophet who was submissive to Allah and was there to prophesy really on behalf of Allah, who is in Islam the one true and one and only God. Certainly Jewish neighbors and friends and Jewish beliefs throughout the history of the church and the history of the world have viewed Jesus very differently than Christians have viewed Jesus. They don't believe Jesus is the revelation or perfect revelation of Yahweh, certainly not God in the flesh, nor would they trust in the historicity of his resurrection or the substitutionary mm-hmm. reality of his death. So there are a lot of competing beliefs. And I think one of the things when we start to try to, like this podcast is aiming for, faithfully explore hard questions, is to try to represent. This is just a good conversational, apologetics, cultural engagement principle. You want to have the best version of the competing arguments. That's what you want to treat seriously.
Yep.
And I think a lot of Christians are trained to treat the worst version of competing arguments. And subsequently, when they meet the best versions of them, it strikes them as totally disorienting because they've never really been asked to consider, hey, this is the best version of some of these competing objections. So let me just ask you this, going back to the where I started. What if we're wrong? Have you ever considered that? What if you're wrong? How do you know you're not?
Yeah, and I think I would want to segment it according to each of those different dimensions that we were just talking about, where people might say that we were wrong about Jesus, that they're absolutely interconnected. But, you know, what if I'm wrong about Jesus being fully God and fully man, for instance? Like, that would be one of the central claims about Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think there, so as I read the Gospels, and we're going through Matthew's Gospel in our community group at the moment, so sort of, you know, particularly deep into that Gospel, and noticing how time and again, Jesus is saying and doing things that really only God has the right to say and do. So if Jesus is not both fully God and fully man, then the Gospels just can't be authentic testimony about him. Like, actually, I don't have a whole lot of time for people's, for people perhaps, but the argument which says, if you read the Gospels, you'll find that there's, you know, a very plausible version of events which says Jesus was just a, you know, compelling prophet, teacher, but not never really claimed to be God. I actually find that quite uncompelling. So
I agree.
So if the Gospels are our best historical access to Jesus, which even skeptical scholars would often acknowledge, if Jesus isn't God, then we actually, we can't hold on to pieces of Jesus at that point.
I agree.
Like,
100%.
Jesus is, it's all gone.
I agree. It's, I think it really is all or nothing with the gospel accounts of Jesus. It is.
Yeah. And even when it comes to the question of exclusivity, it was fascinating. A few weeks ago, we were looking at this passage, I think in Matthew 7, but you can tell it's right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. That's tail end of Matthew 7. I get my chapters very squiffy.
No, you got it. Matthew 7.
So Matthew 7, where Jesus says, so whatever you wish others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Like, I could put that on a yard sign in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, and my non-believing friends would like give that a big thumbs up. But then right after that, Jesus says one of his most unpopular things, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. We can't separate out Jesus's popular and unpopular teachings.
I agree. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's tempting is, and this is without diving too into the weeds of some of the more complex conversations behind it, though maybe one day we'll get there. I do think that we feel about the testimony about Jesus in the Gospels that we can just kind of take and leave what we want. And this isn't unique to skeptical minds approaching Scripture. I mean, Christians do this all the time with the parts of the Gospel that that are congruent with what we want to think about ourselves. And then we leave on the table the stuff that's a little bit more like sandpaper. But I do think that one of the things that's very, and this, that's a great passage to point to, that's clear, is that Jesus is not divisible. You cannot just be like, I'll take a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's all or nothing with him. And I think that's actually a good thing. You know, probably the number one, getting to kind of where I want us to go here, when I engage with non-Christian friends and neighbors, I would say that the one thing they feel most offended by when you really get to what the Bible says about Jesus is around his exclusivity.
Yeah.
Around, like, like, they, again, like, your truth, my truth, they're fine if I want to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, he's the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one can come to the Father, the true God, for salvation and for flourishing except through Christ Jesus. They're fine if I believe that. Mm-hmm. But the moment I say, no, it's actually true regardless of belief, and it's true for everyone, everywhere, throughout all time. Now they're going, whoa, hold on. Like, now we've jumped the shark in their mind. But I actually think the exclusivity of Jesus is one of the best parts of the message, because Jesus's exclusivity as the way to God is coupled with a radical inclusivity regarding who can come to God. Because so the reality is Jesus is saying, I am the only way to God, but anyone who comes through me will be welcomed into fellowship with God. So there's a radical inclusivity that's attached to the radical exclusivity. So when I talk with folks, I'll often tell people, listen, Jesus is making a radically exclusive claim that initially is going to shock you. But that radical exclusive claim is the foundation for a radically inclusive invitation, which is that because he's the only way to God, he's also extending an invitation to say, you don't have to try to jump over the fences. You don't have to go try to find another door. I am the door. I am the only way to God. And all who come through me will enter into fellowship with God, regardless of where you come from, regardless of your background, regardless of what your language is, regardless of your culture, your ethnicity, regardless of how much money or how little money you have, regardless of your sin and how it's manifested in your life in the past. If you come through Jesus Christ by grace through faith, then you can come to God in salvation. And that's radically inclusive.
One of the things that's been really striking to me as I've read through the Gospels sort of again and again for writing about them is the fact that you can only come to Jesus basically flat on your face. Like, you can you can come with need, and we see people in the Gospels who come with a sort of physical need for healing for themselves or for somebody they love. We see people come because they're deeply aware of their own sinfulness and they need Jesus for that reason. You come to Jesus with whatever's prompting you, you come with your need and you sort of fall down on your knees in front of him. Those are the people Jesus lifts up.
Yeah.
If you come to Jesus like the scribes and Pharisees tend to do in the Gospels, where you basically are there to critique and to question and to be like, no, I'm not very impressed with what you're doing. Actually, you're not living up to my standards, Jesus. Those people just miss who Jesus is, and they just don't get him. Like, both sort of literally and sort of figuratively, they can't see who Jesus is. And I love that moment when he's being critiqued by the Pharisees for spending his time eating and drinking with sinners. And he's like, oh, don't worry, it's not the healthy you need the doctor, but the sick. I haven't come to for the righteous people, but for sinners. And you can sort of feel the weight of Jesus's statement, where they may be thinking, well, that's okay, I'm righteous people, don't need you. In fact, he's only here for the sinners. And until we recognize that we are the sinners, we're not going to get him. We're not going to be able to access him.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
So I think Christians have room for confidence in terms of what we believe about Jesus. But when we're asked questions about why we believe what we believe about Jesus, questions of epistemology, questions of knowledge, questions of how we know what we know, that's the question of epistemology, knowledge. What is knowledge? How do we know what we know? Mm-hmm. And in a couple episodes back, we kind of answered this question broadly. How do we know what we know? How do we know anything? So we kind of dove into this, but how do we know we're not wrong about Jesus? How do we know that we're not wrong about something as central, fundamental, and catalytic as Jesus Christ is the Son of God, Creator, Lord, Savior?
Yeah, yeah. I think a super helpful place to go on that is to look at whether the four New Testament Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are giving us reliable eyewitness testimony about who Jesus is. It was interesting, a few minutes ago, you were talking about the best versions of opposing arguments and how we should always, you know, look to articulate and engage with those rather than just the sort of straw man that we want to knock down. I think that's true. I think it's also important that we engage with the most powerful rhetorical moves of opposing arguments, or the most frequently used metaphors.
Yep.
And one that I think often is used to undermine people's confidence in the Gospels, if they're already Christians, or to reassure people they don't have to take the gospel seriously if they're not, is the metaphor of the telephone game, where people say, you know how in the telephone game, you know, one kid whispers a message to the next kid, and the next kid whispers the message to the third kid, and you kind of go along the line, and then the kid at the end of the circle says out loud what they heard, and it was laughably different from what the first kid was told. And you know, a number of skeptical scholars and sort of public intellectuals have used that as a comparison for how we've got the New Testament Gospels. That, you know, maybe somebody saw or heard a thing and then they passed it on to somebody else, and that was passed on to somebody else, and we've ended up with this very kind of garbled version.
Right.
And I've heard it applied both to the gap between, you know, when Jesus was teaching and performing miracles, and when the Gospels were written down, and also I've heard it applied to the manuscript evidence we have for the Gospels to know that we've got the access to the original text that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote.
Right.
And it's super compelling. Like it's a super powerful metaphor because we've all seen a message get corrupted like that. But it's actually a really poor analogy to how the Gospels came about when we think about the testimony of the people who, the many people, you know, so we've got not just his 12 appointed apostles who, you know, traveled around with Jesus, memorizing his sayings as a good Jewish disciple of a rabbi would do, but also the many other informal disciples he had, including a number of women who are cited by the gospel authors as eyewitnesses of Jesus's life, death, burial, resurrection. The Gospels are written well within the lifetimes of those first eyewitnesses.
Right.
And as far as we can tell from a, you know, historical perspective, looking at the ways that biographies were written at that time, the Gospel authors are very much intentionally pointing to eyewitnesses as they write their texts for us. So it's not that, you know, one person heard a story about Jesus and passed it on to somebody else, who passed it on to somebody else, and eventually that person wrote it down. Actually, no. Of the probably hundreds of people who heard the original teaching or saw the original miracle, there were then, you know, let's say dozens of eyewitnesses who were kind of carrying that memory forward.
Yep.
And then it was written down well within the lifetime of those folks whose full-time job was traveling around with Jesus and observing what he did.
Right.
And then after his death and resurrection, their job was going around and telling others about it. So it's like if I said to you, you know, hey, Kyle, it's not like if I said, like, do you remember what you have for breakfast, you know, this time 10 years ago, or even last week, you probably got no idea. It's like, hey, Kyle, remember that conversation that changed your life when you were 20?
Right.
Give me a summary of it now. I want to write it down.
Yeah.
Like, of course you remember.
For sure. And I think that not only is that a very significant point about the credibility of the sources of knowledge around who Jesus is, I think it's also important to remember one of the things I've found people is kind of the point underneath your point, which is helping people, Christians or skeptics, understand how ancient history worked. Like how ancient history as a genre functioned, because I think we often think of historical veracity as being purely contained to like the modern period. Like we could only really have kind of truthfulness around what happened historically from our vantage point. And yet, I don't know if you follow, if you read biographies, or you could read 10 biographies about Winston Churchill. Lord knows there's probably 10,000 of them. But you could read 10 biographies about Winston Churchill, and there's going to be consensus on his existence. There's going to be consensus on probably the day he was born. There's going to be consensus on the day he died. There's going to be consensus on the text, the very specific text of speech that he might have used for speeches in the House of Parliament. There's going to be consensus on a lot, but there's also going to be interpretation. I think modern people, specifically in the global West, are often thinking about history as like interpretation free. History is just like the detached, plain accounting of factual, biographical, data-driven information. But that's not how history worked in the ancient period. It's not how history works now. I think you could make a compelling case that one of the most formative pieces of historical work in the last 10 years at a popular level is a musical. Where founding fathers rap and where founding fathers have rap battles in the Oval Office. Nobody watches that and goes, yeah, of course, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson had a rap battle in the Oval Office to discuss this pressing issue. Do you understand that history is told narratively in a way that can still be true and yet may not accord with what you understand as this a very like linear, data-driven approach to the historical record? And Rebecca mentioned a few things there. If you were like really wanting to explore that, I would point you to Richard Bauckham's work on the Gospels as eyewitness testimony. It's far more accessible than it looks. Like when you're going to look at the book on Amazon or wherever you're going to buy it, you're going to go, this isn't for me. It's far more, he's a great writer. He's a great thinker. And it was that book, The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony, that helped me kind of reconsider and reevaluate how I thought about the Gospels as a genre and as a reliable source.
It's funny though, you brought up the Hamilton analogy, and my 12-year-old right now is obsessed with Hamilton. Like she absolutely she listens to the music all the time, and she just recently read an 800-page Hamilton biography. Did I already tell you this?
No, I don't think you did.
So she is deep into Hamilton's life.
How old is she?
She's just turned 12.
And she read the Ron Chernow 800-page biography on Hamilton?
Indeed. She was totally into it. And she kept coming to me as she was reading this book. She kept coming to me and saying, Mum, Hamilton is a much worse guy than he seems like he is in the musical. Like the more I understand the details of his life, the less impressed I am with this. She's like, he's basically not a good guy at all. Like Eliza is legit a good person, and like Hamilton really not. I hate to break everybody's hearts if you haven't read the 800-page biography. And I think the experience that she went through is precisely the opposite of the experience that you will go through if you sit down and read the Gospels.
Agreed.
Because if Hamilton is kind of like the highlights reel, you know, Hamilton the musical is sort of like the highlights reel of Hamilton's life with basically the best possible gloss on him. And, you know, oh, well, yeah, he had an affair, but like it was really hard, you know, all the things. It's very much a presenting Hamilton as a hero and glossing over things that won't seem so heroic. But as you dig more into the details, you find him less and less attractive. I think the Gospels happen the opposite way around. That if people just have a general idea of Jesus from like Sunday school one day, or you know, picked up in the ether of Christian culture around them, the more you sit down and actually read the Gospel accounts of Jesus' life, the more compelling he's going to be.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. We've been talking about believing, knowing Jesus, being confident in having true knowledge about Jesus. But I think it's important that we just maybe pan out for a second to go, well, what really is essential to believe about Jesus? Because we know that there are things that are often associated with Jesus that are either not true or they're not essential. Let me give you an example of a not true thing about Jesus. Like, if you grew up in America in the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years, and you saw a picture of Jesus. Now, we've gotten a lot better about this in the last 20, and hats off to publishers for correcting the record. But if you were engaging with Christian resources that visually depicted Jesus in America in the last half of the 20th century, you saw Jesus as white. Almost
not just white, but like blonde hair and blue eyes, kind of like
that's
hyper white. Yes.
Hyper white. Yes, that's not true. Obviously, we know that there's simply no way that that would have been a clear depiction of Jesus. So that's a not true thing that even in our collective imagination is often associated in the global West with Jesus. But what about something that's not essential that's often associated? Maybe meaning that it's true, but it's often treated as an essential when it may not be. I think one of the things that's often treated as an essential that probably shouldn't be is Jesus's views about or what we might project upon Jesus in terms of his views around something like matters of secondary doctrine, creation of the world, for example. I've heard people say before, well, Jesus references the creation in a way that accords with a seven-day literal creationist view. Ipso facto, if Jesus believed it, I should believe it too. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say I think it's true that Jesus seems to look back on it and refer to creation in a way that's often congruent with seven-day creationism, but I don't think that the context around Jesus' references to that are primarily making an argument that would go against kind of a alternative views of the creation record, young earth or old earth. So that could be, it very well could be true. It's just not an essential belief. Somebody could believe it, all the essentials about who Jesus Christ claimed to be, what he claimed to do or and what he did, and not believe something that it appears that Jesus might have believed or didn't believe or maybe could be projected upon.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's helpful. And not that this is an episode on science, but it seems to me that people sometimes smush together the absolutely vital Christian belief that there is one God who made the heavens and the earth and everything and everyone, you know, from nothing originally and is entirely in charge of our creation from beginning to end. Like that seems to me to be a belief that is fundamental to Christianity and not a sort of nice to have.
Yep.
How God created seems to me to be, you know, important, interesting, but actually not fundamental to our understanding of the scriptures or of who Jesus is.
Yep.
So I'm open to people, you know, having different views and debating all day long, as Christians have done since at least the fourth century, you know.
Yes.
Exactly how God created us. The question of whether God created us is absolutely first order, non-negotiable. Yep, question of how seems to me to be, you know, very much one that it's useful to have conversation around, and that we shouldn't, you know, be breaking fellowship with people who take a different view.
Yeah. And so when we're thinking about essentials to believe about Jesus, what's the true knowledge that we're seeking? Well, the church has historically said, and we think that it's the distillation of the witness of Scripture, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God in the flesh. Two natures, one person, fully God, fully man, that he lived a perfect life, meaning he did not sin, he did not commit evil, he was not marred in any way by unrighteousness, either in condition or in action. And that he died a substitutionary death to accomplish the forgiveness of sins, to make atonement on behalf of man with God. And then on the third day, he rose again from the dead. He then ascended to the right hand of God the Father. That's kind of like, mm-hmm. Those are the essentials of who Jesus is. Two natures, one person, what's called the hypostatic union, and that he lived a sinless life and he died a representational or a substitutionary death for the forgiveness of sins. He rose again. He's not dead any longer. He rose again in an embodied way. The early church was very concerned about true belief about Jesus. Many of the early councils are organized around questions about who Jesus is, who Jesus was, who the church would proclaim and worship him to be. You think about Council of Nicaea and Chalcedon in particular, two of the earliest councils that developed creeds. Those creeds have been treated through the history of the church as the received belief and confession of global and historic Christianity, meaning I might not have, maybe me and my Roman Catholic neighbor would have a disagreement over some element of the doctrine of salvation, but me and my Roman Catholic neighbor share essentially the same view, provided that they are cognizant of their faith, like I am cognizant of my faith and vice versa. we share functionally the same view of who Jesus is, at least from a doctrinal confessional standpoint, that we both believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God, two natures, one person. You can find African Christians and Asian Christians and Central European Christians and South American Christians. And our unity, even though maybe some of our practices might be different, the language we use in worship might be different, our worship style, our preferences might be different. Maybe some of we hold some beliefs in secondary or tertiary relationships that would be different from one another. But the thing that unites Christians together is our belief in who God is and who he has revealed himself to be in the Son of God, Jesus Christ, the second person of the Godhead. That's kind of the glue of the Christian faith. And that's one of the reasons why having a degree of confidence and true knowledge around the question of Jesus is absolutely fundamental and integral to the Christian faith lived and practiced.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think there are some areas of belief when it comes to Jesus that people will see as like, maybe this is a second order. Doesn't matter if you really believe that or not. You know, one that comes to mind is like, was Jesus really conceived by a virgin? Yeah. Like, was he actually born of a virgin, conceived by the Holy Spirit? Like, is that something that's like essential for us to believe as Christians? And it seems to me that, in fact, it is, precisely because of what you were just explaining about who, like, Jesus's divine nature.
Yeah.
That God actually did something truly miraculous in Jesus's conception, and it's far and beyond actually any just regular common or garden miracle that we see in the Gospels of, you know, maybe Jesus healing a blind person or helping, like enabling somebody who couldn't walk to walk. This is the incomprehensible miracle of the God of all the universe taking on human flesh. I mean, it's like, it should blow our minds today, even though we're kind of familiar with the idea, it should like be truly mind-blowing to us. But it's even more mind-blowing to, you know, poor Mary, not poor Mary, sorry. Like, but like think about Jesus's mother Mary, who is living as a faithful Jew under Roman dominion. You know, the Jews at that time living under the boot of the Roman Empire, so under pagan overlords, clinging on to their completely bizarre belief that there is only one God who made the heavens and the earth and everyone in it, contrary to all their pagan neighbors, contrary to their Roman overlords. And then it being revealed to her that in fact this one true God was going to have a son who was also her child. I mean, like the wildness of that news for a faithful first century Jew is hard for us even to get our minds around.
Yeah.
Because sure, there were stories told of the pagan gods impregnating human women and like, you know, having demigods here and there.
Yep.
But the God of the Bible was nothing like them. This was a totally different, like this is the utterly transcendent creator God we're talking about here.
Yep.
And I can only imagine what sort of went through Mary's mind as she was visited by this angel. But then, you know, when people say, well, yeah, I mean, the idea that Jesus was born of a virgin and didn't have a, you know, human father, it's like, well, you know, maybe that's a sort of nice to have rather than an essential belief. Like, actually, I think it's just intrinsically connected to our understanding of who Jesus is as the very Son of God.
Yeah, no, yes, I agree wholeheartedly. I remember a number of years ago, I feel old now because of it was a lot of years ago, but the book, I won't mention the name of the book, but a book came out by a Christian pastor and writer who basically called into question the necessity of the virgin birth. And it does feel a little bit to me like one of the things that I often feels like we're kind of trying to take away with one hand, what we're trying to build with the other, is that there are often times where global Western modern folks will kind of like treat the culture of the culture, ancient culture, as like with a pat on the head. Oh, well, like they couldn't possibly have known better. Like how sweet and how childish were they? You know, like what Lewis talked about, chronological snobbery, where we look back and we're like, well, of course these desert nomads, these peasants in the backwaters of the world couldn't possibly have considered these things. And I often wonder if we just know how arrogant and how truly racist and classist that approach to historical reflection is. Because it does feel like we're very willing when it comes to the claims of religion broadly and Christianity specifically to look back on the ancient cultures that were the crucible of their formation, or at least the circumstances of their narrative, the context, where they were, and to kind of pat them on the head. It's like, well, we've certainly progressed beyond these simpletons. Mm-hmm. And often case, I don't think you have to look too hard at ancient cultures to realize that in many ways they were more sophisticated in reflection than we often are. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, we ourselves are not nearly as advanced and as wise as we often take ourselves to be. And yeah, I think many objections around Jesus and the historicity, the veracity, the truthfulness of his claims, the objections to those often scan and read to me as modern enlightened people, quote unquote, looking back on a culture that is not their own and treating it in a way that they would never do so if the claims of religion weren't the main contested claims they were dialoguing about. They would never do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. I think to just sort of put a little bit of a twist in that, though, one of the objections or critiques of the Gospels that I find almost amusing is the idea that the Gospels were somehow sort of massaged by the early Christian leaders,
right,
for political reasons, that they were, you know, propaganda, you know, the best angle was presented, and we can't, right, really trust them because, you know, of course we know people in power change the narrative all the time. It's also easy to read the Gospels and think, gosh, the first disciples, especially the, you know, chosen apostles of Jesus, the 12 Jewish men he'd hand selected.
Yeah.
They seem so foolish. It's so it's like embarrassing how, you know, Jesus will predict his death and they start arguing about who's the greatest.
Yeah.
After the resurrection, the women come back to them and tell them that they've seen Jesus's empty tomb, and the male disciples, it seemed to them an idle tale and they wouldn't believe it, you know, as Luke says.
Right.
So if there was an airbrushing being done, whoever was airbrushing should have been fired. Like, they did an incredibly bad job.
Oh, for sure.
Because it's an embarrassing portrayal of the people who went on to be the most, you know, powerful leaders in the early church. And to me, that is one of the signs of authenticity in the Gospels.
Yeah.
Is, yes, they point a beautiful spotlight on Jesus, but they actually throw shade on his 12 apostles, like, again and again. And I can only imagine that they allowed that, you know, Peter and the other guys kind of allowed that to stand because it was truly what happened.
Yeah.
And they were more interested in the spotlight on Jesus than in their own, you know, shiny reputation.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's really well said. And there are so many rejoinders and faithful responses to some of the questions and objections. I mean, that's a great one right there that you often hear. I think another one is, you know, when we think about, you'll hear people say, well, you know, Constantine at the Council of Nicaea, there were political machinations to make sure that that this particular view of Jesus became the authoritative view, even though it wasn't the biblical picture. It wasn't the picture of who Jesus Christ, the moral teacher, Jewish rabbi, was. And yet, those views typically, or that skepticism, is so unfounded. I don't know if you know much about the imperial cult of Rome. The one thing that the Caesars didn't want was to codify any competition to their own lordship. So for a Roman ruler to be like, yes, I believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, was not something that was going to codify power for him. It was something that was going to minimize his political power, maybe even jeopardize it, as we see throughout the history of the church. So it is surprising, I think, that sometimes the skepticisms that are treated most seriously are the ones that probably should have the least amount of stock attached to them. And we're going to get into these in the seasons ahead. You know, I think one of the things that'd be good to, just as we land the plane here, we've gone far and above the time I thought we would. How do we constantly...
We can't help talking about Jesus.
Evidently. I guess that's a good thing. If you're going to get, if you're going to go overboard on one thing, this is probably the one to go overboard on. Let me ask you this, Rebecca. How do we walk confidently in the way of Jesus in a way that's faithful and persuasive and humble. You and I both have like people in our lives who we love, who do not think that Jesus is who we think Jesus is. And we don't spend all our time, like, it's not like we're constantly texting them, you know, articles like, you know, 10 ways you know you can know that Jesus actually rose again from the dead. You know, we have those conversations when they arise. We initiate them some of the time when it's appropriate, but we're not constantly just like firebombing our friends and neighbors with like, here's, you know, 25 defeater arguments for the truthfulness of Jesus, you know? How do we do this in a way that's humble, faithful, and persuasive? Maintain the integrity of our convictions about what we believe about Jesus with a way that's inviting and winsome. How do we do that?
I think if Jesus is truly central to our lives, and I feel like that's a daily battle for me to keep Jesus truly central to my life, because it's strange. It's almost like there's a sort of spiritual opposition to that happening in my life. It's almost like there's somebody out there who's wanting Jesus not to be central to my life. I can't imagine who that could be. If Jesus really is central to how we're thinking and how we're living, and if we are having meaningful conversations about things that matter with our friends, then Jesus is naturally going to come into those conversations. If we are regularly part of Christian community, as we go to church on Sundays, as we meet with fellow believers in the week, you know, we, for example, host a community group at our house every Tuesday evening. And so, you know, it just comes up in conversation with my non-believing friends. What were you doing last night? Oh, we had community group. We talk about Matthew's gospel and pray for each other. Like, there are ways that if Jesus is central to our daily rhythms and how we think about the questions and challenges that come our way in life, and if we're pursuing real meaningful close relationships with non-believing friends and not just keeping everything at the surface level of, oh, isn't it hot today in Boston, which by the way, it is very hot today in Boston, then I think those conversations are going to come up. And if we can be introducing our non-Christian friends to friends who are Christians who they may have a connection with, that could be just a super helpful way of having different angles on Jesus coming into their life. You know, if somebody who maybe has a totally different upbringing to us, or a different life experience, or a different racial heritage, or a different age, coming and also being a witness to Jesus in their lives, that picture is going to start to be built by a group of people around a friend of ours. So I think, inviting people into our lives, both our own just individual lives and also the life of our communities.
I think that's exactly right. That's a good place for us to land the plane today. Hey, listen, thank you for tuning in and for listening to us as we ask these questions. If you want to ask a question, you can leave a review of Confronting Christianity on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And we would love to take that question into consideration. You can find Confronting Christianity on Instagram and Twitter. Check out Rebecca's recently released books. Whether you're looking for Jesus Through the Eyes of Women or Confronting Jesus, you should check them out if you're interested in exploring who Jesus is more. We did recommend Richard Bauckham's The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony. Would strongly encourage you to check that out as well. We hope you enjoyed the discussion today. Grace and peace.